Oh, yes, we're on the air. The hard restart worked. Yes. Can you talk?
I'm talking right now. Hello.
And you're coming through, I think. Oh, nice. I like it. I think we're bringing in the horizontal, but not the vertical. There's no TV. It's just horizontal. DS106 Radio. I have to apologize to Scott Lowe. I heard the 30s music and I just assumed it was him. And so, it's not the case. He's Scott Lowe is vindicated, Lauren. It wasn't Scott Lowe. It was some other figure. But anyway, DS106 has been liberated. And Lauren and I are about to chat about Utopia and more. Literally. Okay. So, Lauren, how are you?
I am good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm on the radio. I'm glad I figured that out. It wasn't as quick as I hoped it would be. But it was worth it because I really wanted to chat with you about some of the things you shared with me this week. This is the second episode. Let's do a little like station identification here. This is the second episode of what we're loosely calling Utopian Tendencies. And I like that you like that title.
We should be definitive about it. It's called Utopian Tendencies. There's nothing tentative about it. We're on the second episode.
We are on the second episode of Utopian Tendencies. Shabam. The other thing is it's May 15th, right? The Ides of May. It's 2020, right? And the radio, it's Friday afternoon. The radio was some kind of being held hostage by some kind of technical problem that a reboot didn't work, but a hard restart set it free. And so that allows us to move in to our utopic visions of what's to come on the radio. So, Lauren, without further ado, let's talk about Utopia and the limits and possibilities of this show.
Okay. So, I suggested that we talk about the original book titled Utopia by Thomas More, written in or published in 1516.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you said you actually studied it at undergrad as well, so you're now the expert on this radio show. Like,
I am.
I know based on the Wikipedia page a little bit about it, but
it's interesting. I read Utopia in my undergraduate literature course in UCLA, and the way they did it is they had like they didn't do semesters, they did quarters, 10 weeks, and they broke up British literature into, you know, 3 10-week chunks, and we read Utopia, Canterbury Tales, some of the Shakespeare, Beowulf, like, and it was very much, the English department there was very much focused on English literature, like it was British literature, and they had a lot of great scholars who studied Milton, who studied Defoe, who studied Shakespeare, many of them British. And so it was interesting, but it was a really structured early British literature department. And I read Moore or parts of Moore as part of undergrad. And I was tripped out on it. There's a couple of cool things about that book. The fact that it's written as a kind of series of letters, as an introduction, and then kind of fantasy in part two. The idea that it's, you know, both a critique and a satire, a la, you know, Jonathan Swift, 200 years later, you know, kind of an early vision of that. But just the whole idea that it deals with early studies of, like, possibility in America, right? Because it's based loosely on Amerigo Vespucci's 4 journeys to the New World. and he kind of derives some of his, you know, imagination, as so many did at that point in Europe, on this whole idea of this brave new world, which gives birth to this whole idea of utopia and parallel alternatives to what we're dealing with. And so I loved it. I think it's a great place for us to start episode two. But you said, and I want to throw this back at you, you said you want to talk a little bit about, like, almost the derivation of the word. There's a word for that, like, you know, where the word comes from.
Oh, yeah.
What is the word? It's how Italians etymology? Do all their literature. That's right, yeah. It's how Italians do all their literature. It's all etymological. they're not very interpretive.
I just liked just the idea of a nowhere place. So it literally means nowhere place or nowhere land or whatever. So we were talking about like sci-fi and different forms of literature exploring the ideas of utopia, but like it as a tool to, you know, imagining a non-existent place and the use of fiction to help us think through possible models or kind of critique and think through our current models of organizing ourselves or how the world works. Just, I don't know, a nowhere place as a way of doing that, just like projecting all our ideas onto a non-existing fictional place.
Yeah,
I don't know. I just thought it was cool. And then it later gets the kind of connotation of it being like a positive idealist space. But with this initial book, it's as well like there's I don't know how you felt when you read it, but apparently like this like ongoing debate about whether Moore was trying to think through an actual real place that you'd want to exist, because the book goes through different models of governance and like how you would organize like smaller communities and then how you'd have an overarching governance for this island, as well as like how you how the legal framework works. So it has this idea of the only laws that exist, they're kind of easy to understand so everyone can understand it and you don't need lawyers, so everyone is able to act out the law and kind of argue the law because it should be easy for everyone to understand and things like that. Where is it going with that?
That they were kind of it was almost like a place to imagine some of that, right? It became like a blank canvas for them to imagine an alternative social system.
But also like the idea, so there's this ongoing discussion about whether he's critiquing the existing world or whether he's critiquing the idea of being too idealist or whatever about the kinds of worlds that you can create. And there was an interesting, I wrote a note somewhere, I put my phone down, that was the issue. The idea of working within current systems and in real situations to make them better rather than like trying to hope to start again kind of thing. Like is it worth trying to build or find a utopia elsewhere? Or yeah, I don't know. There's things around like him as a politician and a lawyer and things like that, what is the role of a philosopher or a politician or a lawyer and things like that. And but all of it is kind of, it feels like it's more questioning those things rather than trying to propose that there shouldn't be lawyers, like because he's a lawyer and he obviously cares about his role or whatever kind of thing. But he, in this world, he argues that actually no one, there shouldn't be lawyers. Yeah. Like in an ideal world, there shouldn't be lawyers. And you can hold that view. He might have believed that, but also in our real worlds, would we ever have a governance system or a law system or whatever else where you wouldn't be able, you know, you wouldn't need lawyers kind of thing. So it's kind of constantly being playful and kind of satirizing those things.
It's interesting too, like your point there about the real world, right? And there's a kind of like, it's almost a cultural, a historical moment, right? Where you have thinkers who are obviously thinking through what it means to be in a position of leadership, to be a philosophical figure, so someone who has a broad learning, right? And then what is that relationship to, like, the real politic, right? Which Machiavelli, who published his Prince not that much before this, a couple of years earlier, and had to have influenced more, talking about, you know, the only way to get things done is with a real kind of manipulative, and I don't think that's what Machiavelli totally said, but it came across as, you know, you have to understand the context, you have to understand the situation, and you have to be willing to make sacrifices within the reality of what you're dealing with. Oftentimes that might mean force, you know, not just negotiation, but kind of like a political treatise on what it means to negotiate and the birth of a field like political science. And I do believe that more in some ways is playing off almost the opposite of the real politic, right? Of Machiavelli, or what that emerges as, is actually, like, absent of that context, what would be possible? Like, the whole utopian vision of, like, without our kind of necessary, you know, caveats based on our situation, what could we do? What could be possible? And I think that's one of the cool things about it, is, like, it opens up a whole, like, hey, you know, blank canvas, like, what would you do? Almost more of the Rousseau school. You know, if, you know, Machiavelli creates a school, Rousseau tries to create a kind of, based in nature, this whole idea of, like, blank slate, and you can control what comes of it. I think the other thing that Moore is operating on, and they said this in the Wikipedia article, which I read, and I remember it coming up in the class 25 years ago, is one of the big things driving British thinking and British, and I'm not speaking as a British historian, but at least from the literature point of view and that part of the history, was enclosure. And so was this idea of space changing and the kind of transition between what considered public space in a very different way and private, and that negotiation. And I love that, because that was a theme that went through a lot of that class, was also when we got to Defoe and Daniel Defoe's early novels, right? In particular, Robinson Crusoe, or Molly, what was that one called? I'll remember it, but she actually goes to the New World too. And this is a century later, that birth of the novel in some ways, a lot of that is dealing with the economic uncertainty of England at that point in time. And so it's super interesting to think about Moore thinking utopia is not a place where you could have private property, is not a place where any of those assumptions that came to be in, you know, the changing British thing would work. Now, my dog is barking, so I'm going to hand it back to you. It's a good idea that I'm talking too much.
Yeah, because you're talking about, like, it's discussing, like, the enclosure of land and stuff like that. So, like, there's different things. Like, he's critiquing kind of paragraphs at that current time. So this kind of people kind of that have means to enclose land or whatever, kind of obsessively going after sheep farming, but not necessarily thinking about the other forms of labor that might need to exist or whatever else. Yeah, I don't know. You were saying as well about lots of ideas at the time around kind of what you need as a statesman kind of thing, and it's some of it kind of pushes back on the ideas of, like, how to best advise a prince and things like that.
Yeah.
But he kind of deliberately kind of does away with that by, yeah, there is, so does away with the difficulties of enclosure by there not being private property, and you kind of all have to organise and stuff like that. But also that you have that everyone is, like, on the island is pushed to kind of pursue education in their spare time, and that you then nominate someone in your smaller communities to kind of escalate to another form of governance, who then they pick another person, and it kind of is on. Not quite, it's not democratic or whatever else, but it's kind of a way of deciding who would already have the skills through pursuing education and knowing their communities to kind of go up to the point of there being a prince on the island and stuff like that. So just kind of doing away with the need of advising or whether you should have philosophers within a court system and things like that. It's just,
it's interesting, right? Like, I mean, the role of a philosopher in those contexts, and it's kind of what Machiavelli, you know, and, you know, even more, you know, goes back to Plato, and like, there's this whole sense of like, you know, are we being well advised with the changing system we're embarking on? Like, there's almost a constant returning, like with the opening up of the new world, there's this sense of like infinite possibilities, particularly in Europe as they're starting to colonize and explore. And, you know, over the next 200 or 300 years, there's this, you know, whole new world opened up to them. And I found it really interesting in that our whole push for talking through this stuff has a lot to do with, you know, the utopian kind of balance with some of the technologies we talk about and some of the ideas of, you know, broader cultural ideas of films, TV, so many things hold on to this idea. But technology in our last 20, 25 years, particularly the web, has been an outlet for this like none other, right? And I think you can liken that to this shift with thinking through the new world and new possibilities. But the idea that so much of that, just like now, is tied up with the birth, what many people say of this notion of capitalism, right? Like enclosure is a really early kind of instance of a changing economic and political system that would then define, you know, the history of the world. And that's safe to say, I don't think I'm over exaggerating that, for the next 500 years. So the birth of utopia as a place where that's starting to think through in this Sir Thomas More piece is really interesting, because it's directly related to a financial emergence too, right? An emergence based on new markets, an emergence based on colonialism or what's to be, an emergence based on how do you deal with when you have too much, too many resources, and how do you kind of turn that into profit, and how do you deal with labor, right? Like, it was interesting in Sir Thomas More's book that, you know, slavery was still a thing, like even in utopia. It's not going away.
I think I was interested as well, like, with it is a projected idea of what could be, and like, even if we're not sure whether Thomas More believed in all the different things, because there's like he's pushing against like ideas of enclosure, and he sees that basically, like, people being executed for theft is like utterly ridiculous, and he kind of makes this argument: you might as well encourage people who are robbers to kill the person that they've robbed, because you know it's the same punishment regardless of whether they've murdered someone or whether they've committed theft. And he says that people are pushed to theft because they can't support themselves because of enclosure, so they can't feed themselves or they can't make a living through whatever work and resources they would have had access to otherwise. So there's interesting things like that, but like you say, there's still laws that if you have extramarital affairs or whatever else kind of thing, you become enslaved, and then you have to labor for other people's households or whatever kind of thing. And it's still, I don't know, there's weird kind of hypocrisy, kind of like weird absurdism sort of in that.
And women couldn't really get beyond, I mean, it was impossible.
They're still stuck in that.
Exactly. I mean, the interesting point is it's, you know, in 1515 when that's being written, or 1517 when it's being published, it's still impossible to imagine women outside the domestic sphere in some ways, even though you can argue the domestic sphere is something that comes up later in different contexts, at least the way it's defined in literature and stuff. But like, it's interesting that there's real boundaries to the thinking there. Despite, you know, having a free canvas, you're still locked in to the conditions of your time. Yet some things seem really forward thinking, like you said, capital punishment. Like, and their discounting of like, that's a stupid idea, and this is why. So it was interesting, that balance, and it was nice to go back through that. But you brought up an awesome point as we were preparing for this, and you talked about the way in which a lot of this stuff relates back to mapping. And I am super interested in that stuff, and I'd be interested to get your take, because I do want to talk a bit about mapping and this early world, because it opens up a whole nother idea of the projection stuff you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I think like having to pin ideas to kind of a concrete idea of space. So like this, so Utopia within this book is an island kind of thing, and it's located in the New World off the coast of Brazil or somewhere like that. Yeah, so it has this specific geography, and it talks about its size and its shape and things like that. It's in the shape of a new crescent moon and things like that. And then how the cities would all be kind of located across the island. But the idea that it kind of makes sense when you're talking about if geography is important for something, but that we kind of, when we think through ideas, that we have to project them onto a space and the way I was really taken, this is the second essay that we were going to, the second text that we were going to discuss as well, but I liked how the two link together through maps kind of thing, like that we have to, so the second essay is on cyberspace and virtual spaces, but that we have to kind of map out concepts or non-physical spaces or even kind of philosophical ideas. So we have to kind of ground them in some sort of idea of space.
I think that was, two things there. One of them is, like, I didn't realize that there was a map based on Moore's Utopia that was come up with, and this whole idea, and I think I'm not going to get the Latin right, but it's like mundus mundi, maybe, like this idea of like how you map and the evolution of mapping and the evolution of geographies and like what that means for representation, how that means for a sense of perspective. My wife studied travel narratives, like from Italy in particular to like Southeast Asia, and the way in which these folks not only told their story of conversion, whether it's to, you know, Islam or all this other idea, but then their attempts to map that. And the Roman Catholic Church using those maps as a real thing of power to understand, to retrace, and then also to define whole groups of people outside the scope of their mapping. And so she did a lot with cartography and that notion of desire and othering and super cool stuff. And the thing that came back to me with Moore is you're talking about the mapping of utopia, right? And so mapping of something that you're basically literally drawing, that's almost your canvas is the map, right? So if we're talking about this art piece, the map becomes a really interpretive, creative act, right? That could be used for all sorts of like, you know, also questionable things. And that idea maps so brilliantly on top of the essay that you shared. And I just want to say live on the radio how much I love the essays you've been sharing for these discussions. Like, and I'm serious. Like, I think they're brilliant. This one is Ingrid Burrington's Dimensions of Citizenship. And we'll include the link when you're out, but it's Ingrid Burrington, Burrington, and it's called Dimensions of Citizenships, and it's an efflux, and it's a brilliant, brilliant essay. Like, how would you summarize the essay before we get into details and make the click? Like, what would be your 30,000 feet overview of the essay?
The journal episode was called Dimensions of Citizenship, and the essay is Effortless Slippage.
Did it wrong. I didn't get the essay title right. That was a very nice way of saying that. You're very polite.
Just like trying to subtly put a correction in there.
There'll be many corrections throughout the course of this radio show, and all of them attributable to me.
I think I'm trying to remember when it came out. I think it was
2018.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it kind of looks at kind of the history of how we've imagined and mapped and kind of visualized what ApparentNet and the internet and the web kind of are, and the ways that we've tried to kind of assign it a space kind of thing and talked about it as a space. So I don't know, she starts off by kind of briefly discussing J.P. Barlow's Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace and it kind of being a manifesto for cyberspace existing outside of real world kind of government control, and it's this alternative space and things like that.
Which I hadn't read, and I still haven't read J.P. Barlow's Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace. And I love it how she's like a Wild West conveniently lacking in genocidal baggage. That's how she describes it. She's like, yes, this manifesto, a Wild West conveniently lacking in genocidal baggage. I was just like, that's a great term. And you knew where she was coming from right at that sentence.
But it is that kind of links back as well to, you know, with the Thomas More's utopia kind of projecting this new world on, projecting this idea of an island onto the new world and the possibilities there, that the same notions for the kind of independence of cyberspace come from that kind of Wild West ideas of, I can't remember what the Latin is, because like the new land or whatever, that's how like America was described. It was in the kind of European imaginary when most people obviously hadn't been there, that it was this just wide open space full of all these resources and no thought to people kind of living there, that it was just this blank slate that you could project your new idea of what you wanted to build for yourself. I think we just need to get over the ocean and then we can do whatever we want. And so again, that idea reoccurs with the internet kind of thing, that we have this new space, we can organize ourselves, we can make it to be whatever we want, and existing governments and states should not involve themselves, kind of thing, because it's this new space that we're going to claim.
You know, and then, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go.
No, I mean, I'm loving that. And I think one of the things that was interesting right away in her essay, she says, she brings up the ARPANET, and she says, some of these gestures were more of a literal attempt to translate the borders of the world onto the net, such as ARPANET legend John Postel's decision to assign two-character ISO country codes to every nation as top-level domains. And like right away, she's mapping or connecting the idea of a domain name. In this case, she used like .ny, .us. And the UK, right, you would have ac.uk. Like, there's a lot of those vestiges of that kind of domain naming system still around, you can see. And she talks about that as kind of an inkling and like an early impulse to imagine the web physically, right? Like as an address, but also as something that has somewhat of a shape of a nation, right? Or of a state or of something. And it was interesting because I don't know, have you ever, and it really reminded me of this project, and I wonder if the two are related, but Tim Owens connected me to a site, and I don't know if you've ever seen it, called citizen-x.com.
Okay.
So it's citizen-x, so EX, citizen-ex.com. And what is on there is super interesting. It's basically stories about top-level domain names. Like .io. Like, I didn't know .io was based on the British Indian Ocean Territory. That's actually a military base that they've driven out all of the people who are part of, and the military base is a U.S. base. And it was just interesting to think about how much, you know, of empire and colonial impulse is built just on top of something as simple as a domain extension, like .io. And I really started to see the connection between the piece you shared, which I love so much, and a broader question about how is this almost invisibly mapped network we all inhabit always about power relations we can't see or map? Because not being able to map them is in some ways, you know, enables them to kind of move freely, right? Or move into places that we don't see. Yet she talks in this essay so much about the fact that so much is mapped, and it's mapped by these few companies and these few entities, you know, namely Google Maps, which that whole discussion is amazing, changes the way in which we see the web, but not only the web, the world in which we live in is, you know, constitutively redefined by the web, which is trippy. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, so the essay goes through that of, like, she kind of builds a history almost to how we've projected ideas of almost like around land, or how we'd organize land, or create new nation states and stuff like that for cyberspace or the internet or whatever, and then looks at how the internet has developed, or how companies on the internet have kind of tried to visualize their space, how that's in kind of all the technologies that have developed through the internet, how that's impacted on our understanding of physical space and physical geographies, kind of things. So, like you're saying with Google Maps and Google Earth, how anyone being able to access satellite images of the Earth, how that impacted our understanding of our own planet, but also Google Maps' decision to have kind of geolocated interpretations of how to map space depending on where you're located. So it talks through is it Ajax, the kind of the way repurposing that technology, finding new use to have I'm gonna have to scroll, how many pixels, it's like 265 pixels square tiles or whatever,
that's right,
that make up the map every time you load a page on Google Maps. But depending where you are in the world, you'll see a different selection of tiles. So she shows screenshots of whether you're on the Russian side or the Ukrainian side of the border between those two countries, where the border is positioned on Google Maps. And it can do that based on, basically when you refresh a page on Google Maps, it kind of shows these small tiles that kind of, mosaic together or whatever to make a picture of a map. So as you move around, it can choose based on where you're located physically, as well as where you're trying to look virtually, how the map will look to you, kind of thing. So names can change or languages can change, but physical borders and things like that can change as well. So yeah, it's that two ways of thinking about how we project ideas of physical space onto cyberspace, I suppose, and then how the technologies we've developed through the internet, or how people decide to organize that, how that projects back on to how we understand our own planet.
Which is really a great description of what she's writing about, and that whole time in which she digs into Google Maps and Google Earth and talks about Ajax, the technology, but just like you said, the example of looking at Ukraine from the perspective of a Russian versus a Ukrainian looking at it is a very different experience based on what Google gives you, which is crazy. But the other thing that was wild is she uses this as a way to talk about disinformation bubbles. So like we've been talking a lot as, you know, culturally this exploded with Brexit and then with the election of Trump, that this whole idea of we're living in these information bubbles and they're driven by, you know, these major kind of platforms that are kind of in some ways gilded by their understanding of information, but also, you know, this sense of being trapped in it. And there's this one paragraph from it I want to read. It's a little bit long, but I don't think it's wrong, long. But I want to read a little bit from it and then talk a little bit about this, because I want to map it to something else I've been thinking about and see what you think. If you think, stop reading to me, you can say that at any point. Like, stop reading to me, Jim. Don't read to me. And I won't take it personally. So she says here, and this is from the essay, which is called Slippage, right? Effortless Slippage?
Yeah.
Okay. The tendency of users to remain in filter bubbles and propagation of myopic communities via platforms and recommendation engines has been well documented, as has the tendency of these narrow environments to enable mass harassment misinformation and propaganda campaigns. I mean, it's so relevant, right? In response, companies offer resources on media literacy and piecemeal hiring of content moderators or fact checkers. But placing the onus on individuals to season their news feeds with opposing viewpoints rather than, say, designing a platform optimized for bringing multiple viewpoints to users, or assuming the issue is the ability to critically discern sources rather than recognizing that many users are entirely media literate but happen to hold racist or fascist beliefs, suggests platforms consider power something that the invisible hand of the market has clumsily pushed them into against their will, and not something abused in the absence of a meaningful praxis. Furthermore, it assumes that greater legibility of a user and their nuanced perspectives is a desirable outcome. Users have agency to reshape the territory of their digital bubble, but they remain map subjects. Boom! Shaka! Like, for me, like, the whole thing there is like, maybe digital literacy is the last thing we want. Like, these people are digitally literate, and they're fascist and racist, and they're like, you know, like, but for me, it's like, how do you manage that? Like, is it the fact that everyone's been put into one place to highlight that effect? Or do we want to not, as educators, or particularly in the world of ed tech, acknowledge that media literacy may not entirely be the issue, but it's a more structural kind of, you know, focus on allowing that stuff to happen some way outside the praxis of governments and rules and regulations and, you know, people being held accountable. What's your reading about that? Because I was struggling a little bit with understanding, like, where she's coming from in terms of the balance of media literacy and the idea that people don't understand how these sources work, and the balance of her saying, no, people are media literate, but that doesn't mean they're going to hold views and assumptions that you do. It's not means that through media literacy they're going to be somehow enlightened subjects, you know, of the utopian tendency, so to speak.
I think it's because I suppose she's trying to challenge the assumption that if everyone had the same level of literacy, that somehow things would be better and the things that people would want to discuss online would somehow change. Do you know what I mean? But you being able to communicate better, or you understanding that technology is better, doesn't mean that you're suddenly not going to hold the racist and fascist views that you might hold, kind of thing. And lots of the people that are advocating for people to become more media literate are doing so because they want to challenge the fascist or kind of rhetoric or kind of information that's being spread online. And yeah, so she's trying to challenge that assumption there. I think I suppose, like, I don't know, with different social media, you're kind of the point of them is for you to kind of share content in some way, and those platforms don't really care what content you share. So there's no there's no need on the behalf of the platforms for you to have a nuanced view or for you to know how the technologies work. You just need to continue to create content and to view content so you can view ads or whatever else, kind of thing. So it's just trying to challenge, like, would everyone being media literate or whatever meet the ends that we're looking for, kind of thing. So it could be, so I really enjoy that, because to me we need because also this links to the Thomas More utopia as well, where he's talking about people's access to education. And if everyone has, he imagines this world that everyone shares whatever the amount of work is that needs to be done. Like, everyone basically is an agricultural laborer in his world, kind of thing. Everyone shares the amount of work, and basically people don't work more than 6 hours a day. And then all of the rest of your time is put into your communities and then you learning and stuff like that. So linking it a little bit back to that, I think the issues here are, do people have the opportunity to explore political ideas or think through ideas philosophically or think through what things they would want to discuss or kind of make online, or is it kind of reactionary based on the views that they already hold? Do you know what I mean? And where, thinking through where those ideas actually come from. Because some of it will be people just, they'll have read one particular kind of filter bubble idea and they're projecting that as a megaphone. So if someone might kind of pick up, you know, obviously with in the case of Brexit and Trump and things like that, people kind of cling on to those ideas. Like the term Brexit was made by a tabloid and then everyone started shouting Brexit and it became this thing because someone had attached a name and then that name stood for something that never became tangible. Like we never had an understanding of what Brexit was and people in our country didn't know what the European Union was or what it did or, you know, how the economic zone functioned or anything like that. But Brexit stood for something in their mind that was like a projection of all the ills or frustrations they might have at that time kind of thing. So
Utopian and that kind of thinking, if you will.
Yeah. So it's kind of like doesn't really matter. I don't know. Yeah, it's I would say she's kind of saying that media literacy alone isn't going to solve things if people are still going to hold those views. But I would say, then how are we going to support people to decide on their own terms how they want the world to work or think through what's best for their communities and all that kind of stuff, rather than just parroting whatever else they've seen online?
I love your linking that back to Thomas More's Utopia, not only for the idea of the philosophical and that kind of moment where they were hoping that people would lead with ideas, right? And a sense of responsibility and maybe, you know, project something beyond that, but also tying it into this notion of like space that Moore is dealing with and not just imagine space, but at home, right? Like they were dealing with this sense of enclosure and these enclosed spaces. And I think part of what she's getting at and what I liked about her is she's kind of slippery. Like the slippage is not only in her discussion of, you know, the complexity of the situation, but I think she understands that. So she's not taking a right or wrong. And I loved it when she challenged media literacy like you did. But there's also this sense of like this overarching notion of these platforms and enclosing all of this stuff within a meme-driven kind of environment that allows things like Brexit or what have you to kind of explode in a way that, you know, it almost becomes not only an echo chamber, but right, like it almost, because it's this enclosed space, right, it almost is, the pollution is, you know, it's almost like this dome of pollution that kind of reinforces itself and does exactly what Google did for the maps, right? It changes the way in which you look at the world based on the environment that's serving it to you. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a really elegant and subtle platform critique in this paper that's super, super interesting. And it because I can't stop talking, it's a disease I have, so you have to forgive me. But I was thinking about it, and it's like so many of the Marxists of the last 100 years, 200 years, were geographical Marxists. No, 200 years might be an overstatement. But like David Harvey, who's still a big Marxist working at the Graduate Center, still teaching Capital. Neil Smith, who was from Scotland, he was a geographical Marxist, and they were actually, Neil Smith was Harvey's student. And these are people who I studied with at the Graduate Center and what was and in New York City. And what was interesting about that is they talked a lot about this idea of the pioneering rhetoric to talk about gentrification, to talk about the way in which cities were kind of rediscovered, right, by the wealthy. And they used a lot of the same rhetoric that Barlow was using for the internet. And one of the things that's super interesting is these rhetorical tropes in the idea of pioneering, in the idea of nations or re kind of, you know, establishing order, you know, in the wild city. They would talk about the savages in the city. Even movies like Fort Apache, The Bronx, talking about the Bronx as if it was a fort on the Western Front with the Native Americans as those wars were going on, was really intentional. And you can see it throughout 80s movies as they're trying to refashion New York City as a place that's no longer inhabitable, right? And it needs to be reconquered, right? And Neil Smith called it the revanchist city. And he used that as a French term to talk about this idea of re-inspiring a kind of move of capital back to the city to reclaim it, and using the tropes of the West. And those same tropes are really mapped, interestingly, on top of the internet. I mean, there's a whole PhD to be written about what that means, right? Like, it is a super cool topic. And I tried to write my PhD on those tropes in films in New York City. I got waylaid. I found ed tech. I became a non-content, right? And moved on. But think about these kind of geographical studies on top of how people are projecting and imagining the internet is super interesting.
I think that's like it's a background fascination of mine kind of thing. I like the fact that you kind of, applying Marxist geography kind of ideas to the internet as well. Because that's all I get stuck all the time. I end up reading stuff like that and then reading stuff about the internet or reading how, I don't know. There's some of the texts I want to talk about in future about, you're pointing your finger like you want to say something. I'm about to ramble and I don't know where I'm going.
Ramble.
So.
Ramble. I can come back. Ramble. Ramble on.
I think some of my interests are like the line between those things and trying to work it out, because that I'm really glad that you picked out this paragraph as well. Like I keep sending these things to you and they're not necessarily having a specific thing I want to talk about. I'm just like, this is like, at the moment, the texts that we're talking about are like, they're kind of almost like waystones to my thinking, but I haven't necessarily gone through them and kind of critiqued them before or kind of picked them apart. I don't know. Yeah, I just like your point, I think was my point. I can't remember where I was going.
Well, that you can never go wrong with liking a point of mine. But that just means I'll make more points, so that's dangerous.
That's
but
fine.
I do have something about Marxist geographical criticism, because when I was doing this stuff to look at New York City, Neil Smith was like, you should read, and let me find it, you should read The Condition of the Working Class in England, which is an 1844 work by Engels. And it's really interesting. Do you mind if I read you this bit from it?
Go for it.
Okay.
This is so cool.
Let me find it. This is cool. I love this stuff. And I don't have any occasion to talk about it because no one listens to me anymore. So if I can have someone who's interested in this stuff, and Tanya, I think Tanya's listening over in BC. Hi, Tanya. So this is us talking about
it. I should have, this week I haven't grabbed books. I should have grabbed books. I've got I'm reading E.P. Thompson's Making of the English Working Classes, which is all talking about trying to get, that's a tome. It takes a long time.
But I've got loads of books. The Tocqueville did this for America, and I studied early American lit and then went to film and then dropped out. But I really loved early American literature. So that whole Vespucci, that period I was super interested in, was the period from colonial forward and the exploration. But the exploration was kind of hard to write about, whereas I really liked the whole early colonial before it became a nation state, which brings up questions I have about this essay towards the end, and we'll talk about that. But Friedrich Engels, right, he did a famous commentary, and it was written in the first 2 years after his arrival in Manchester in 1842. And he says this about Manchester, which is kind of ground zero for the Industrial Revolution, right? Which is another point historically we can mark. Like, we're just covering it all. So anyway, Manchester is peculiarly built so that a person may live in it for years and go in and out daily without coming into contact with a working people's quarter or even with workers. That is, so long as he confines himself to his business or to pleasure walks. This arises chiefly from the fact that by unconscious tacit agreement, as well as without spoken conscious determination, the working people's quarters are sharply separated from the sections of the city reserved for the middle class. Manchester contains at its heart a rather extended commercial district, perhaps half a mile long and about as broad, and consisting wholly of offices and warehouses. Nearly the whole district is abandoned by dwellers and is lonely and deserted at night. Only watchmen and policemen traverse its narrow lanes with lanterns. This district is cut off by certain main thoroughfares upon which this vast traffic concentrates, and which the ground level is lined with brilliant shops. These shops bear some relation to the districts which lie behind them and are more elegant in the commercial and residential quarters than when they hide grimy working men's dwellings. But they suffice to conceal from the eyes of the wealthy men and women of strong stomachs and nerves the miserly and grime which form the complement of their wealth. And he goes on to describe the way in which Manchester is built as a girdle around which the poverty are kept out. And there's certain roads that the wealthy can go in and out to the city and never have to see any of the poverty. And I thought about this when I thought about this idea of these very intentionally created and defined bubbles. Bubbles of information, right? Bubbles that keep a certain population in, exploit another. And the way in which a lot of these kind of analogies between what she's talking about with geography has already been mapped on top of cities in some really powerful, interesting ways, theoretically, literarily, like however you want to, historically. And so there's a lot to think about when we're thinking about the internet and this notion of cities versus the unexplored, you know, West. And it's very easy for us to kind of come into these dualities of, you know, the cultured, well-defined city and, you know, the far kind of savage, the dark web, as it's called, think about that. And then not realize the complexity of the inequalities within the very cities that supposedly are defining that culture, or the inequalities that make that culture possible. It just really maps really well, in my mind, and I might be imagining this, onto this. He actually says, and it goes on, unmixed working people's quarters stretching like a girdle, averaging a mile and a half around the commercial district. And this idea of a girdle, right, is super interesting, not only because it's a visual like metaphor of like holding the body and protecting it, but also maybe keeping it together and holding other things out, is a super like, I don't know, fascinating image for like, is that what Facebook is? Right? Like, is that kind of these platforms, what they start to kind of created? And, you know, what's the, it'd be interesting to do a really technical study around some of these images and these visuals. And I'm sure people are, but I am intrigued by it deeply.
I think, that maps really well. I think as well, intentionally, because as well, like, so some people live, like say in Manchester at the time or whatever, or other industrial areas, some people did live in kind of some kind of places, but often factory owners did build housing and kind of intentionally built, you know, like streets or whatever, where people would kind of go from there to factory or wherever they need to labor and things like that. So, and there was an intent to, like, you know, you'd have window knockers, so like, if you heard about like people with massive sticks that would just like tap on every house's window. But the idea that you could have a window knocker that would just go down the street tapping on everyone's window, and then it would only take like 3 to 5 minutes or whatever to walk into wherever they need to go to work or whatever. So like Facebook is almost like, you know, it doesn't care if the masses on there are media literate or not, and kind of thing, or really what they do there, but it's kind of almost deliberately formed for those people, or at least now it is kind of in the kinds of people, maybe this isn't kind or whatever, but like the kinds of people that use that space are the people that wouldn't necessarily be able to build their own spaces, or maybe aren't looking for, I don't know, like other areas, like maybe forum type spaces or whatever else, where you would want to discuss things in any depth or kind of hear other opinions and whatever else. It has a different function.
I agree. And I think it's also that back to that enclosure that Moore was talking about. There's a form of that enclosure, obviously, but it's far more developed by the time Engels starts writing in the wake of the Industrial Revolution. And if you think about that in terms of just mapping on Facebook, despite the fact historical differences, and it's not one-to-one, you know, but there is a form of an enclosure of whole communities now, right, where they've built an experience, they've made it convenient, they've made it easy, they made it a suburb-like living, right, on the web. you know, and it's almost like with Moore, and we were criticizing him earlier, but you can see that in our own imagination of the web now. Like, it's hard for people to imagine outside the notion of a stream. It's hard for them to imagine outside the notion of a feed that, like, is fed with, you know, advertising and is driven by a transaction of your personal data. Like, all of these things are artificial creations, but they've become to be absolute. Like, it's unthinkable to imagine a world apart from, you know, Facebook, you know, with its, in the way in which it's a nation. It's bigger than the biggest nations in the world. That comparison haunted me throughout this essay. People always saying there's 2 billion Facebook users, you know, there's only 1 billion Chinamen, right? Like, it's like this idea that Facebook has become a nation state, but something more, right? Like, it's not even just an extra, it's like an extra nation state. It's like a nation that has no rules, no regulation, no real kind of, you know, controls in place to manage what happens, right? It's kind of interesting in that. It almost takes us to the Ursula K. Le Guin we were talking about. Like, these crazy sci-fi situations we only imagined a week ago. Like, kind of, they come home.
There's things like, with Facebook, I'm sure, I mean, we could find, there'll be people that have written about this, but, you know, like, if you get locked out of your account, you have to show your passport and things like that. And there's been loads of issues where people have actually shown their passport and Facebook says, no, we don't believe this is you. And, like, people around the world basically having names that Facebook don't accept are real names. It doesn't really matter what the names are. It's just, it's based on, I suppose, who Facebook chooses to employ and whether they think different names around the world are legitimate or not, kind of thing. But even that, like, having almost like passport control about who can access Facebook. I don't know, there's something I was thinking about before as well. I don't know, you know, I'm trying to work out now how this links in, but I think it's something about, like, the people on Facebook don't use it however it exists, you know, as a platform, but you feel a need to be there, or that people end up being there because there's no other space for them or whatever else. And you were mentioning about, like, Engels' kind of description of Manchester and stuff like that before. I was thinking about, do you know about the Peterloo massacre and, like, that as a moment of fighting for suffrage in the UK? So, like, the Peterloo massacre happened in 1819, so the 200 year anniversary was last year, but basically 60,000 people gathered in Manchester to fight for male suffrage and for men to have the vote, because I think it was like only 10% or something like that of the population, like the male population of Manchester had the vote at the time. So it's like literally one MP represented a million people or something like that in Manchester, because you had all these people that basically, so at the time you had to own property and I think you had to be over the age of 31 possibly and be a man to vote. And so basically Manchester was so poor because everyone was literally there to, you know, carry out industrial labor or whatever. They didn't own property, you know, they were living in one tiny room with seven kids or whatever, so they had no democratic voice, kind of thing. So, and this is around, this is after the Napoleonic Wars, so you also have loads of people were working in kind of mining leads and stuff like that. So at the same time as well, you have people fleeing to America. So I have relatives that went, they were lead miners, and then they went to Pennsylvania and then ended up coming back, kind of thing, and stuff like that. So at the time wheat prices shot up because of there was like famine across Europe. Lead mining and manufacture related to the Napoleonic Wars kind of completely collapsed. And you had all these poor people in Manchester, some of which didn't have work, or everyone was working piecemeal, so they couldn't earn enough to feed themselves and stuff.
Sounds familiar.
You're
really starting to paint a picture now.
So 60,000 people gathered in the centre of Manchester to protest and just ask for recognition or, you know, for help, kind of thing. Basically, guards came and started shooting people, and there was like stampede and stuff. So like men, women, and children were killed, kind of thing. But that was the Guardian came about because that newspaper started up, and I think it was like the Manchester Evening News or something like that. I can't remember what it was called. Started up, Manchester Guardian started up, because they wanted to report on that specific incident. So they became an investigative journalist kind of outlet because of that. But also, out of that, people started advocating for male suffrage. So eventually, more men got the vote, kind of thing. But that was like a moment in UK history around trying to fight against that. But I was thinking, like,
yeah,
it kind of parallels quite well with Facebook being, if Manchester is now Facebook.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you almost need that moment of people, not that you want to mask it, but people like fighting for some level of suffrage or whatever, to have a representation, a voice of how that space is organized, or have access to organize their own social space or whatever else.
I tell you,
it fascinates me. Like, Facebook has become, I have different like older relatives that literally they collect together information about like their local history or family history and things like that, and share. And there's huge community groups, like you might have like a whole town's like history is represented through a Facebook group, but they only know of Facebook to organize and share that kind of thing. And I've tried to like gently say, oh, maybe there's another way of sharing that, or it could exist somewhere else, or what happens to these images or all these stories once Facebook's gone, or if you get locked out of your account and all this kind of stuff. But it's just that we don't have another space for it.
It's true, though. I mean, it's like, you know, it's the whole idea of sharecropping, right, is building someone else's, you know, wealth and property for them. And it comes home. And it's interesting because also Manchester of the moment of that for suffrage, as you were saying, in 19, right? Is that right? 1819?
1819, yeah.
And then 1842, you have Engels there and using it as a case, a more developed case of like how that stratification now is layered into the very architecture, right? The very design of the city. And you have to think that Facebook in its 15 years has gone through a very similar kind of shift too. In fact, one of the coolest things about this essay was her talking about a 15-year-old Zuckerberg who actually kind of came up with a Java applet that basically tried to connect people, friends, on the web. And maybe too much was, I liked, she kind of criticized the Social Network movie and like the hagiography of him and jilted, and then he built this network. It's like, no, he kind of had this idea of mapping relationships early on. And the idea that Facebook is, in a sense, a social mapping tool, right? It's mapping connections between people and the power that comes of that. So she does a really, really good job. I want to shift a little bit because I want to read another quote and ask you what you thought about it, because I liked it. So is that good?
Okay, yeah, good.
Okay, it's not as long. So there you go. Okay, so it kind of points, I'll set up the quote. It kind of points to the idea of, so you're Facebook, right? Let's say you and I say, I don't want to be in there. I want an alternative, right? I want to go out. I want to follow Barlow and I want to go out to the cyberspace. Like I want to go out to the Wild Wild West. And so she talks about that as an alternative. And as she does, it's not going to be an easy either or. But remaining on the imagined fringes of the network might only afford us the kind of freedom Barlow opined for in 1996. The convenient imaginary of outlaw cyberspace, the wild frontier in which white men can always mean well while moving fast and breaking things, or where the privileged prepper can build her own infrastructural enclave apart from the platforms, but remain no less complicit in isolationism. And I like that last part because I love the whole prepper idea on the internet and the whole survivalist. But like, here's another interesting moment where no one's, right? Like there's no good option also outside of Facebook or Google in some ways, according to this essay. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think it just, yeah, if you tried to start something tomorrow, it wouldn't fill that space. But she does advocate at the end that people need to, she's kind of has this call to action that people need to think through how to create alternative spaces and stuff like that. So yeah, I think you as an individual, if you decide you're going to manage your own space because you want your own information in your control and, you know, whatever else, or you make a space for your small community, you're still, you're only taking care of yourself or a small collection of other people. You're not looking after the masses that are now trapped within Facebook or however you want to describe that. So it's how to imagine and then create an alternative to Facebook or the platforms or tools that we use on the web that do service that community, and maybe think of it through dimensions of citizenship rather than, like if people need these social spaces where they're sharing their local histories and their lives and all, you know, like how do we provide that alternative? And you doing that as an individual on your own, trying to decide, well, instead of putting my information within Facebook and whatever else and just having your own space isn't enough. You have to think, how are you going to support other people and like pull other people up out of Facebook or whatever.
It's interesting because one of the final quotes, she comes back to J.P. Barlow, right? And she says, you know, towards the end of his career, more recently, I don't know if it's the end of his career, he said in an interview with The Economist, over the decades, it has been continuous, and I'm quoting him, it has been continuously fashionable to make a straw man of my declaration, to hoist it up as the sort of woolly-headed, hippie nonsense you'd expect from techno-utopians like me. Yeah, utopia, we did it. Perhaps then it is more constructive to expand upon what even Barlow admits, with a glaring absence in his declaration. In that same interview, he noted that had he had a chance to revise the document, I would make it more obviously clear that I knew that cyberspace was not sublimely removed from the physical world, and therefore, to some extent, beholden to the laws of government that maintained its infrastructure. And I think she does, like you say, really kind of lands her point very nicely there. I think one of my struggles with the article and the essay, and it's a good one, it's kind of generative because it makes me want to go and think more about this, is, you know, the impulse, like she does, she tries to refuse the impulse of saying, oh, I'm going to happy in Facebook. No, I'm a techno-libertarian. I'm going to go and be utopian on the fringes. And neither one is a clean option, like you said. And I think the other question she sets up here is reverting to national kind of structures. And I think depending upon where you are national right now, there's varying degrees of faith in that system and what that means. And now there's laws and regulations and a whole infrastructure that we could depend upon. And I'm not saying the opposite is desirable, but when we're talking about citizenship and nations and the struggle often there, particularly like a lot of the work on the early American stuff was done around these African-American slaves who became freed, and then their struggle to get anything resembling citizenship in a notion of, you know, not only in the US, but in the UK and traveling that whole Black Atlantic, that notion of what it meant in the different notions of fluidity and identity, that's a struggle with the nation state too, right? It's not like you don't remove the same struggles you have. It's almost like the problems of the nation state in some ways have been inherited by these platforms, but without any of the regulations, right? Like the same struggles without any regulations. So it's almost like you're holding on to the one that at least had some political and legal, you know, regulations, rather than the Elon Musk situation we talked about last week with, you know, hey, it's a brave new world. There's no regulations here. Let's go take over Mars and make it what we will. So it's struggling because it's kind of not utopian at all. It's realpolitik, right? It's the whole Machiavellian idea that we're struggling with on this whole show right now. And damn, we did a good job of aligning topics and themes throughout. I'm pretty proud of us.
Yeah. I think it, yeah, I am as well. I think it's like, the Thomas More thing with Utopia. I'm now clutching my face to try and remember what I was going to say. I'm trying to build a visual image of what's going on here. My struggle to articulate a point.
Yes, it's important. We're on the radio.
I wanted to go back to More's Utopia because it isn't clear cut and it isn't pretending to be idealist, and it is just this struggle of kind of going through, almost like More thinking through his own role and whatever work he's doing at the time, kind of thing, and the role of other people that he admires, and having this like letter exchange back and forth. But whether we're looking at it through our kind of contemporary lens or his kind of thing, it's not a perfect ideal world, and it's just showing up all these things. And I like this essay because it's not, I think there's something, it goes through that same thing. It's showing everything up and it kind of exposing it, but not, it doesn't provide you the answer. She's not saying follow a nation state model or whatever else, and she's actually exposing that any of those alternatives at the moment wouldn't work, kind of thing. But I think there's something I find kind of almost like hope and positivity through feeling like I'm clearer on something.
Yeah.
Like if I can see it from different points of view and have different analogies and different ways to think about it, I don't feel as like confused and then like sad, like feeling like fatalistic about things. Like I feel like, oh, actually, I know the ground that we're on now. Like I kind of can see the lay of the land. Like, what could I do now? Or what could any of us do now to change things?
Yeah.
In the future, kind of thing.
I also felt hope in the idea of mapping, like the sense of thinking through the importance of mapping, like historically in terms of spaces, control, surveillance, right? Who gets mapped, who doesn't, like who's a map subject, as she says. But it made me think of a book that I wrote about, I listened to a great, maybe we should play it on DS106 Radio at some point. But I listened to a great discussion with the author of a book called The Undersea Network. And her name is Nicole Staroselsky. And I might not be pronouncing that last name right. It's Staroselski. And she wrote a book and had a discussion about basically mapping the underwater network cables, optical and otherwise, and the kind of impact of that on various nation states, on equalities, on, you know, empire. And so basically did a pretty extensive study of those networks and of the development of those networks. And I would like to, and I've read about it, I've listened to a discussion about it, but that's a book I wouldn't mind reading and talking about at some point. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to suggest anytime soon because we got to get the book and read the book. But it's kind of interesting because it goes back to our discussion today about mapping, about networks, about that real physical infrastructure that is actually in some ways what a lot of these, you know, cloud providers and a lot of the way in which she even talks in the essay about Google can create an image of the Earth without clouds. Right? Like there's no clouds because of the way in which they can, you know, doctor the image and doctor the experience and create really an experience bubble that is something that we have to come to terms with. I don't know if we can effectively get out of it, right? Because even when we were not in the networked world, there was a form of a bubble. Maybe it was the bubble of who drew the map. Maybe it was the bubble of who wrote the book. Maybe it was a bubble of like who drew the picture. But like this bubble now is almost even more immersive in some ways and more omnipresent, more controlling. So that's another one that this really, really made me think of. I just say keep these essays and themes going because I think it's great. I love thinking and talking about this stuff.
I was worried that I kind of want to, there's loads of stuff that I could bring up with this essay as well, like just like... like simulation theory stuff, like Baudrillard stuff, and I don't know, yeah, like how, yeah, how is making an image or kind of proposing something is a particular way, lapsing the thing that it is or that it could be, kind of thing. And like, I think, yeah, I don't know, and the whole history of, I like the effortless slippage kind of essay as well, because it kind of presents a history of how we've tried to form and reform images of cyberspace, kind of thing. But that, yeah, that is a thing.
It's interesting. That might be a good way to close, is let's close talking a little bit about that title, Effortless Slippage. And like, what she goes on to talk about that at some point specifically, about what she means by this notion of effortless slippage. And if I'm thinking back, and then you can correct me, the idea is how effortlessly we can slip between what you're talking about, like the verisimilitude, like the creation, being served an idea of where we are and how things are and the condition in which we exist, versus, you know, some alternative, I wouldn't say more factual, because that gets us into a whole idea, but like almost an alternative, like reality to that. Like our slippage is not just you have to be in VR to slip between realities. Like our slippage now is effortlessly in almost every bit of technology we use to kind of, you know, understand or gain information, right? Like, does that make sense? Does that align?
Yeah, definitely. I found that, so she's got a sentence here. As effortless slippage becomes context collapse, as revolutions give way to propaganda campaigns, give way to ethnic cleansing, it becomes harder and harder to escape the feeling of slippage as freefall.
Yeah.
So that kind of feeling, like we're moving from one image to the next that we have. So if we have these, if we have a history of images of the internet as maps, kind of thing, that each one gives way to the next, but we're kind of getting to the point like it's escalated, that we're constantly seeing a reversioning and reversioning of how we imagine this space, or I don't know.
Which is interesting, because it ties back also to the small files and to this idea of resolutions. And in fact, in the small file idea, there is like diminishing returns, right? But yet that has its own story, right? And its own vector of value, as opposed to, you know, the way in which the stream and the cycle of news and of information works. Like the value is always defined by how recent, right? How immediate, like how soon do you understand and how quickly can you respond, right? And there's that, like, you know, race to the bottom of information in its own way around, you know, that cycle going to now seconds, not even an hour. 24-hour news cycle is like a second, you know, it's 2 seconds. I got your attention, you're gone. But you'll be back, because we know that it's, it's interesting, because I hadn't thought a lot about trying to do my PhD again, but having these small conversations with you and just like going through stuff that I haven't really visited in 20 years. I mean, I still think about some of the stuff, but I haven't returned to this kind of thinking in a long time. And even as Antonella finished her PhD and she was working on that, and I would talk about this stuff all the time, right? But I didn't really think of it in relationship to the web stuff. Like, I thought of it as different, and I was running a company, or me and Tim were starting up a company. So it was like, my mind was in different places. But it's interesting how just this last two conversations for me have been a kind of and also for me, I used to teach a lot. And as you can see, I don't shut up. And that was always a joke with me and my students, is like, shut up, it's possible. But the idea of talking through some of this stuff and thinking about it is really enjoyable. So thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm getting the same from it as well. It's like, I know I'm always interested in this stuff, and I kind of read it in isolation. I don't necessarily know people until speaking with you, I don't really know people that I could discuss this kind of stuff with, even just like sharing it to people. Like this kind of essay, if you share it to someone, it's like you're asking a lot of someone to
exactly
to try and read through it and then have a conversation about it or whatever. I did my undergrads like dissertation, so like the final year piece that you have to write. I did it on the reconstruction of memory through documentation. Like I basically argued a fictional art exhibition by using art pieces that talk about, not related to the internet, but how we create images to represent moments and like experiences and stuff like that, but like me doing it through a fictional art exhibition thing. But
like the living room, in some ways, sure. The 1980s living room or 90s living room we were gonna build at Coventry.
Yeah,
is that true or no?
Whether you were gonna build
it, not that I was gonna build it, but that it was, I was gonna build it, but
it was a thing at one point. Yeah, I remember being asked the question, if Jim started sending stuff to Coventry, where would we keep it? And I was like, well, I could talk to people.
That's
if that's now a thing I've got to work out. Yeah, but I kind of wonder whether I obviously want to do something with this at some point. It's just the idea of...
Yeah.
I like exploring ideas, but I get torn between... I like doing things that are practical and will actually lead to something. Like the idea of getting trapped just discussing things is like, it's useful, but like, this is my own like existential crisis kind of thing. Like, is it useful for me to do a PhD or useful to go that route? Or am I kind of interested in this just because I want to know how the world works and think through it a little bit kind of thing? I don't know.
The thing I liked about these essays you've shared, I mean, it, to me, and I don't know if this is the state of academia or just writing or whatever, but they seem fresh. They don't seem bogged down overly in what I've had a big problem with in higher ed is A, I was a terrible writer, but B, like I didn't get bogged down too much in details. Not very good if you're a researcher writing a dissertation, fair enough. But I felt like these, like they were footnoting, there were notes, but like, they were also really like invocative of ideas and of images and everything we've read so far, frankly. And so it feels like almost a really beautiful marriage of creative writing and theoretical create. Like, so it seems to me like it's a product, not beyond just like, you know, theoretically, you know, there's a network out there and theoretically Facebook could be a bad thing.
Yeah.
It's actually really well done. It's almost like investigative journalism and geography and creative writing. Like, I really dig it. I don't know if it's a new form, but I really like it.
Well, these are all eFlux articles, so they're from Art, Design and Architecture Journal. And you get lots of art and art theory essays are written in these ways. So as well, I have thought about lots of different points, like should I be going off and doing a PhD kind of thing, but it's also like you can do this kind of form of writing, or it's kind of commonplace to do this form of writing within the art world as well kind of thing. But
I've always
films and stuff like that exactly. Explore these ideas instead of writing it.
But I'm a frustrated artist, I think. Like, I don't have any
you art absolutely
background.
Are
I don't have any art background. I don't have anything to do with the art world, but I always want to make things like that, but they're not like paintings or anything. They're like experiments where we think about the media, which is why Ito's stuff was so cool. Like, well, I think there is something there. I think the more we talk and the more we think, I think the more we can find in terms of that stuff. And I balance that because I can be, the thing with the art stuff is it demands a lot of people. And then when you go down that road, like you get hooked in. And so then you have to have a troop and then you all are doing it and like everybody's committed and then that's fun and you can have it. Like we had that a little bit at UMW's DTLT for a while. Like everyone was in and we were stuck in the same room working together and everybody had these desires. So we did shit and it was fun. But I've always, like, that's part of always trying to return to some of that because it's super fun and it's super generative and you feel good in a different way than most other things. So, I don't know.
Yeah. I think humans are made to make things. Like, that's the, like, we're meant to be making instead of, like, processing other people's information or doing, I don't know, telecom calls and whatever else.
So we weren't made for Zoom?
No, we weren't. There's bigger things than life. Cool.
We were Maybe made we need to, talk to about create that. Great radio. DS-106, yes. Great radio. What we were made for. Damn it, one day we might even do it.
Let's look at the... 1 week I'll find something on the arts and crafts movement. Let's look at that.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm waiting with bated breath for the next installment so we can jump on the radio and talk about it next week. Because that means there probably is going to be a Utopian Tendencies episode 3. It will have scared away all our listeners at that point, and it will just be you and I, and it will be complete freedom.
Okay. Sounds good.
Awesome. Well, Lauren, it's always a pleasure. And
you too.
Until next week, DS-106 Radio is for?
Life.
Yes.
In all caps, life.
It has to be. Hashtag for life. Bye-bye, people.
Bye.